Okay.
Where's right here?
Right here.
Oh, that right here.
And there's your stool.
I don't want to. Right. I don't want to confuse the left right here with the right right here. All right, let's see here. Ah, Jesus. I thought everybody had left. I was about ready to leave. My name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 6th, just like John's, only in 2000. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor people, and I think that's why I'm still here after 14 years. Let's see. First time I was asked to speak, a girl asked me, and she said, I had about 2 years at the time, and she said, I'd like for you to speak. And I said, when? And she said, Monday. And I said, well, that's only 4 days. That's simply not enough time. And she said, why? You were there, weren't you? I said, well, yeah. As a matter of fact, I was. Well, good. Then just remember that and say that Monday. Okay. I have one sobriety date. It encompasses everything. There are some chemicals that I missed out on, but chemicals are a portion of my story. I'm not, you know, this. I'm not a one chip wonder. I've had several brushes with AA, several brushes with recovery, just like I've had a number of brushes with the law. The brushes with the law were a lot more hard. Yeah, they hurt more, both physically, economically, emotionally. I decided about 4 or 5 years ago to try and go back to work. And so the application for the place I was looking to work at was very lengthy. And towards the back, and I think that's where they always put this stuff, it said, have you ever been arrested? And if so, when? And I'm thinking to myself, well, how far back do you go? I mean, this is like, you know, from day one to now, or is there a grace period? So I decided to get online, and I went to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and I did a background check. It cost $25. If you're curious, you can go there and do that too. Not for me, but for yourself. Because I'm not going to give you my information. And it spit out 42 pages of criminal arrest. After reviewing all the pages, I realized there were some they had neglected to spit out. Perhaps they lost them. I don't care. I never kept track of records. I figured there were people who were much better at it than me. Let them keep track. And that's the case. And among my criminal activity, I've got a number of felons. And by the grace of God, I've never had a felony conviction. But my felonies range from delivering with intent to distribute, trafficking, armed robbery, felony possession, and so on. My parents were very modest economically. In fact, a lot of people call it poor. I was not poor, but apparently I was poor by association. They drugged me into poverty. And as a result of these steps, good sponsorship, and a loving God, I remain impoverished today. So it's all out there if you want it. Just have to work for it. When I got arrested for armed robbery, I was in underneath the city of Tampa jail. It used to be 1710 Tampa Street. Funny how things stick out in your memory. You remember addresses and places. And I was underneath the jail, and I had just gotten married, or I was about to be. Yeah, no, I think I had been married. Yeah. But she and my mother came to visit me. And at that time, you were inside, naturally, and they were outside, of course. And you looked at each other through this little square window, and it had a couple holes in the bottom. And you yelled at each other in order to talk. And we talked for a moment. Then my mom asked me, she said, James, when are you going to stop doing what you're doing? The very best answer I come up with, and I pondered it for a while, was I don't know. I'm looking to spend the rest of my life in prison because they just changed the laws on armed robbery. And when asked when you're going to quit, and your best answer is I don't know, there's a serious problem. That was in 1980-81. I didn't walk into the rooms of recovery until 1987. I didn't stay. I stayed long enough to figure out that I still had it figured out, so I didn't need anybody else. So I left. And I got into those rooms as a result of an occasional trip to rehab. You know, it's a rest and relaxation period. Because the addiction of alcoholism and chemical addiction is a job. It's not an adventure. And so any time in treatment was R&R, in my opinion. And 3 years later, naturally, like they say in these rooms, that it continues to get worse. And it does. It did in my life. So in 1990, I went back to the same treatment center, but this time I had to go through their detox unit. And I had some significant events that precipitated that, but the gist of it was before I got to baggage claim on my way back from treatment, I was on the phone to my street corner pharmacist. I was headed for the package store. See, I couldn't handle being right here, right now, and I didn't want to grow up. And I was still too smart for my own good. My young adult, I got down to Florida. I was born in Chicago. I was born in Detroit, but we moved to Chicago because they hated Detroit, apparently. I guess I ought to go ahead and tell you. The people, the woman I know as my mother and her husband took me from a hospital when I was a baby. It was her sister's daughter's child. And I guess you could call that a unique form of planned parenting. But they took me and they had to go because that's kidnapping. Still today, I think that's kidnapping, actually. And so we ended up in Chicago. And I got real sick because I couldn't handle the cold and I was about to die. And the prognosis from back then, they do house calls. Doctors come to your house. And he said, if you want the baby to live, you got to go somewhere warmer. And instead of going to Arizona, which I'm very grateful for, we came to Florida, which I'm just a little bit more grateful for. And I've been here ever since. We got here in 58. And I've been here ever since, except for those occasions where I was out trying to find myself. You know, it's funny how when you're trying to find something, it's sometimes right in front of you. My dad was an alcoholic. My mom was not. I called my mom an alcohol abuser. She'd take a drink about half of it, leave it on the table, and walk away. If that ain't alcohol abuse, I don't know what is. You don't finish your drink, shame on you. But he was a binge drinker, and he was a very radical drunk, and he'd had his share of criminal activity, and apparently he liked to, he had two favorite pastimes, and they were drinking and beating up people and getting married. He liked getting married. He did it a lot. Went to prison a couple times for bigotry as well. Or bigamy. Yeah. It's very closely related. When you get old and feeble-minded like me. And so he went through a period of time where he was getting drunk. And like I said, he was periodic. He would go for several weeks before he would drink. Then he'd drink, and he'd drink for several days. And in that period of time, he got very mean. And he would take it out on my mom. And she was the buffer between him and I. She was trying to save me because she knew if he got past her, he was coming for me. I didn't know this. She told me all this. And so naturally, when those things would get very bad, he would pass out, go to the bathroom. She'd come to me bloodied or beat up and tell me to go jump the fence, go to the neighbor's house, call the sheriff. And I did. And then one night she said the same thing. And this was as bad as I'd ever seen her physically beaten. And I told her no. I told her I'm not going. And she looked at me and I thought she was going to faint on the spot. And I walked past her and I went down to the closet. And I got a rifle out of the closet and walked back to the living room. Loaded the rifle in the meantime and pointed it at him and said, "You've got to go now. We've called the sheriff. They've been out here twice. You're continuing to do the same thing. And if you don't leave, I'll shoot you." He had something to say about that and stood up. And I took the safety off, pointed a gun at him. And I said, "You may, but I'll put a hole in you. And possibly two." And he turned and he walked out. And I didn't see him again for about 13, 14 years. I was 9. So thereafter, it was just me and Mom. Mom didn't have an education, so I had to work all the time. So I worked after school, and I worked all weekends. And I learned about working. You know, it's not a bad idea. But when you do it, make sure they're going to pay you very good for it. See, I was always the kind of guy that wanted to start at the top and work his way to the bottom. Because I wasn't thrilled with the other aspect of starting at the bottom, working. I could even get jobs. I would. What do you call that when you go and apply? I applied well. I interviewed really good. I got jobs I should never have gotten. And at one point, you know, I got this pang of honesty. It's a nasty habit. And about 4 or 5 days in, I was in the office to pick up my check, and I said, "You know, I got to tell these guys the truth. I said, I can't do this work anymore." The boss looked at me and said, "Yeah, we know." I said, "Well, why are you keeping me here?" He said, "Because you keep showing up. That's very important. You know, if you want to keep a job, show up. You don't have to be good at it. Just be on time and be willing to do what they ask you." That was a fundamental thing that I keep with me to this very day, although I don't work anymore. But if I did, I would be on time. So I went through school, I went through high school, I did well, I played sports, I had a lot of potential. My teacher said you had a lot of potential. I had a very high IQ. I was too smart for my own good. I qualified for Mensa, but I figured they were just too freaking boring. So I didn't want nothing to do with them. And again, I had to work. So, you know, when I had money in my pocket, when I was 15 years old, I put the first needle in my arm. When I was 12 years old, I stole my first bottle of liquor. When I started working and earning, I was able to pay people to go into the store and buy the liquor and bring it back out. You got to be very careful when you select these individuals for this task. They don't always return. So I said, "Well, I'm out of here. I've had enough of Tampa." So I joined the military. I joined the United States Navy. I figured I'll do that for 20 years, get out, I'll have 50% of my pay. I won't have to do nothing. I can start a family, start another career. Life is going to be just ducky. Problem was, I was an alcoholic. See, that don't change. That continues to get worse. And at some point, it's unbearable, and you can't slide by anymore. Everybody notices it, and everybody was noticing it. I got out of the service, and the service was what was keeping my disease at bay, keeping it restrained, constricted, restricted. And then from 1978 through 1981, I started on my crime spree. And at times, I was dressed up in a three-piece suit, had thousands of dollars. I was making $1,000 a day or more. And life was good. Because I equated good living with material things, with money in my pocket. The whole time I'm dying inside. See, I thought the military had changed me. I thought marriage would change me. I thought money would change me. But what changed me is my disease. So I started finding out how bad this disease can be. And in 2000, when I left that last treatment center, I had buried my mom. And that was the reason that prompted me to go. I figured now, you know, it's time. Something told me. We get that voice that says it's time for something to happen, something to change. You know? And I kept going, you know, in and out of treatments. I was at the VA hospital out here at the veterans call it the flight deck. And they call it the flight deck because on an aircraft carrier, the most dangerous place in the world is on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier. People die regularly there if they don't do what they're supposed to. And very, very often they don't. And I've seen it happen. So I'm in there, and the reason they call it the flight deck is because they put everybody in there with every kind of problem. Bipolars, manic depressants, neurosis, psychosis, you name it, they're in there. And I'm like, so I don't get no respect there either. Why can't you put me with all the rest of the alcoholics and addicts? You know, get them crazy people away from me. And but I had to find out just how insane I was. And they see it differently, see? They see the insanity for what it is. And I got tired of being in there. As a matter of fact, I Baker acted myself. When you call the police and ask for help, you know, that you need help, that your addiction is too much, your alcoholism is overwhelming you, that you have no way out, you're at your last straw, you're at that crossroads, jumping off place, they want to say, they want to call it sometimes, and you want to, you know, you want to bust a move in the right direction, and they ask you, are you strapped? They are not talking about your financial status. And I said, yes. Thinking they were. About 5 minutes later, there's three cop cars in front of my house, and they're hiding behind trees and shit. And they're on the loudspeaker saying, come out and play with your hands up. I've been tired of hearing come out and play with your hands up. And about that time, my mother-in-law pulled in. I was living at her place and with my wife. And that was the only reason they let me to be there. They would prefer not to be there. Matter of fact, they changed the locks a couple times. But I figured out how to fix that. And, you know, in jail, you associate with some people that can teach you a lot of things. None of them are good. But they may come in handy. And so I'm headed for the VA hospital again on the flight deck. I'm there 6, 7, 8 days, and I'm like, I got to get out of here. I got to smoke a cigarette. And so they had the door open. It was visiting hours. People were just walking in and out. I said, shit, here I go. I'm out the door. So I'm walking out the door. They noticed. They come after me. I started running down the halls. I did just like in the movies. I turned a corner real quick. There was a door. I opened it, jumped inside. Just like in the movies, what they're supposed to do is turn the same corner and go right past me. I'm supposed to open the door and leave. Everything's settled. That's not what happened. They turned the corner, opened the exact same door I opened, found me inside with a mop in my hands. I'm ready to do battle. So, he and I wrestled over the mop. He preferred it more than I did. I let him have it. And now there's a dozen more people right behind him almost immediately. And they were all thinking about me, which I thought was good. So they picked me up, wrestled me to the ground, which I thought was odd, and then picked me up and were transporting me down the hall. I was flying down the hall like Superman, supported by this dozen of folks. And there was this one woman had my head in her hands and she was squeezing my head. It was about to pop. You know, and I'm like, I hope I meet you outside. And they put me in a room. They put me in constraints. They put me on a table and they put a belt over my belly and put my hands and feet in shackles. And I'm not going to have my cigarette, apparently. And they shut the door. And I sit there and I said, I need a distraction. Now, when you want to create a distraction, you need the elements to do so. It needs to be dramatic, often simple, and you must have the means to do it. I said, I need some cover. It's cold in here. They gave me a sheet. I said, it's too cold. I need a blanket. They gave me a blanket. Now I can work undercover. I managed to get my hands out of the shackles. 1 foot, and so I've got 1 foot, the thing over my belly, but I'm able to get to my nether regions and retrieve my smoking material and matches. Under cover, I started striking the matches, one at a time. I was to my last match. They all flared up, went out, flared up, went out, flared up. Last match, I pray. Please, God, let this work. I strike the match, behold, flame. Now I have flame and combustible material. One thing I should say at this point, when you're going to create a diversion, a distraction, something sudden and impactful, such as a fire, and you have the means to build the fire, do not be under the fire. I was under the fire. It did not occur to me that when I lit the sheet on fire, and then the blanket caught on fire, and that was all well and good because it was hanging off of the bed I was on. It was not hanging there for long. So I started yelling, help, fire. Made sense to me. The guy looked through the window, saw the smoke, hit the alarm, opened the door, yanked me off of the cot or whatever it is, gurney, and extricated me from the place. And they're saying, how did that happen? I pointed at that guy and said, he started it. Swear to God. That's how insane I was, see. The cause for my problem is my selfishness, my self-centeredness, my fear. My desire to be in charge, knowing things. You know, the things that get me in trouble is not what I know. It's not what I don't know. It's what I know that just ain't so. That's what always causes me the most trouble. You know, and I was always the kind of person who would buy stuff with money he didn't have to get things he didn't need. To impress people he ain't even met yet. You know, that's the kind of person I was. Egocentric. You know, it was all about me. I sit in there, don't you? That's my chair. You know, they don't go there. That's mine. That's, you know, what's yours is mine. What's mine is mine was my attitude. If I couldn't steal it, I'd just lay down next to it. Act like it was mine. Yep, it's mine. If I was a cat, I'd pee on it. And then I get in here. You know, even my sidewalk pharmacist told me one day, said, Jim, I know what your source of problem is. I know what your angst is. I know what you're up against here. You keep waffling in and out of this, trying to get better and trying to quit, and then you need to quit half stepping. You know, and I'd heard that before. That rung a bell. Half measures avail us nothing. Yeah, I'm hearing it from somebody you shouldn't hear it from. You know? And he said, either get into it or get out of it. There ain't no halfway. And for people like me, there's none. So I said, okay. So I got into it for 10 more years until 2000. I woke up one day, blood running down my arms, in a blackout. And when I came to, I was in my own house. It took me a half hour to figure out where I was. At that point in time, I'm on the methadone maintenance program. That's another half measure, but sometimes it is a benefit. And it was Cinco de Mayo, and Cinco de Mayo coincides with the Kentucky Derby, and I'm at the Tampa Downs betting on a horse that's a 5-2 favorite. That means if you bet $50, you win 20. Big deal. And so I said, I can't lose. I bet on 9 horses. I lost. I couldn't pick a winner in a 1-horse race. Because I wouldn't bet the obvious favorite. Of course not. Duh, that's for suckers. That'll make nothing there. And then the next day, they gave me a test at the treatment center. And I have always failed up until that day a styrofoam cup test. Or a plastic bottle test. I can handle written exams, but when I got to pee in something, I always fail. My wife hated it. She often told me about my aim should improve. I said, I don't know what to do now. They said, you need to go back to relapse prevention. I'd already been there twice and it hadn't worked. I said, what's so great about it? You want me to go to a third time? I said, I got a different argument. I said, let me go back to AA. I went there and I had some brief periods of recovery. If I, you know, do it differently, maybe it'll work. And so she argued that point with the council and said, okay, it's on you. So I started going to meetings. They wanted me to go to 3 a week instead of 1 a week, which I thought they had a very high opinion of that relapse prevention course that had been failing all the time. Instead of 1 hour of that, I got to do 3 hours of AA. And at my last weekend, when I needed just 2 more signatures, I finally said, okay, whatever you say, I'll do. You know, because at first I thought you were lying when you said you had 23 years, 30 or more. Or 2. I said, you're lying. Nobody does that. Nobody's capable of doing that. And they're not on their own. The purpose of this program, this spiritual program of action, is to find a power greater than ourselves that we can rely on 100% of the time. Carry with us every day. Build a relationship with and remain right-sized in it. When you all read the How It Works, you read a reformed version. You read what has been in force since the second printing of the AA literature. A friend of mine is going to read what was in the basic transcript, if she would, if she's awake. Yes, this is Dorothy.
I've heard this before, so I'm sleeping.
Okay, yes.
I'm Dorothy. I'm an alcoholic.
She's going to read the 12-step and a couple paragraphs thereafter. It's not much.
Having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we try to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you 3 pertinent ideas. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. And C, that God can and will. If you are not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away. If you are convinced, you are now at step 3, which is that you make a decision to turn your will and your life over to God as you understand Him.
That's the way it lasted for 2 years, and then they reprinted the book because Bill W. started getting letters, because not everybody was having a spiritual experience like Bill W. had related in the first edition. they were having the educational variety or the spiritual awakening. And it's changed from that point on. Back when they wrote this, for that first 2 years, the recovery percentage of people that got into and remained in recovery was 75% or thereabouts. Today I understand it's 2%. Two out of 100. You look around at your neighbors, and in 1 year, you may see one of them. It's an amazing thing, this thing we have. You know? See, this is about breathing. And when you learn how to stay breathing without harming yourself or somebody else, then you're capable of learning about being happy. It's about love and service, according to Dr. Bob, if you boil it all down. And so I found a sponsor, and I was at a meeting, and everybody there was qualifying, and they were. And by the time they were all done towards the end of the meeting, I thought they'd all been at the same party, got drunk, got scared, got sober, because they were all saying 10, 11 years, 12 years, 11, 10 years, 9 and a half. And I'm like, well, wow, how about that? And I said there with a guy right next to me, said he had 10, and I said, would you be my sponsor? And I'm crying. And he said, sure, I want you to call me every day, and I want you to read this book, or whatever you do to get the information. And I said, yeah, okay. So I called him every day, religiously. I mean, even better than religiously. I mean, I called him because my life depended on it. And after 3 months, I had an outstanding relationship with his voice recorder, but not with him. And there's a funny thing about an answering machine. You get to talk all day and it don't care. You can say anything you want, doesn't take offense. But I had to find another sponsor because I was dying. My self-will had run out. I don't got no willpower, see? You know? So I got another sponsor, and he told me, like John said a few moments ago, he said about doing the 5 things every day, and he took me through the steps. He had me on a step-a-week program. It was like taking out a gym membership or something. Every year now, instead of taking out a new gym membership and going for 3 or 4 weeks and then quitting, I just send one a check. You know, I might as well pay for something and just forget about it. It's less trouble that way. But he took me through the steps one at a time. The only one that caused me any trouble whatsoever was when we got to the 4th step and I had to start writing. I've not seen text at that point in time for 15 years or more. I hadn't written in probably longer than that time. I forgot how to spell. I was the 3rd in the state word association, and again, I was a fairly bright young boy. And now I can't spell anymore. So I kept doing it, and I kept getting bigger pieces of paper, writing larger and writing neater. And we got through it, and I did it. Then we did the 5th and 6th and 7th and 8th and 9th. And when I do a 4-step today, I do the 5th and 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th if necessary. Because a 4-step alone is nothing. Recognizing, finding out what there is not turning over to God. It's not cooperating to get better, to have my character defects removed. They don't always go away entirely and vanish. They get shoved off into a little corner, a little room. And so long as I keep doing the things that I started doing 14 years ago, I get better. And I get to meet people like you. You know, I know you're out there. I hear you. You know, and I'm an example that you don't have to see. You don't have to drive. You don't have to read the information. If you want it, you'll get it. I was on the board of directors at the AA Tri-County office a couple of times, and during one of those obligations for service, well, we got it set that if you can't see, if you are dyslexic, if you have trouble comprehending the written word, you go in there with your sponsor and ask for it in another format, and they give it to you for free. And if they don't, come find me. And I see that they do. Or I'll buy it for you. Today, you know, everybody talks about all the things they went through before they got into recovery. Since I've been in recovery, I've gone through divorce. I've gone through homelessness. It's important to know when you're homeless that you're not just camping out. It's always a distinction you want to keep in mind. I've gone through a year of chemotherapy to get rid of a bug that could have killed me. I've gone back to court and said I did it, he didn't. And I've gone through foreclosure. I've gone through having a house that I was living in condemned. And today I have a house that if I could find aluminum cans, I could pay the mortgage. It's only $70 a month. I've been in it for 10 years. It took me 3 years to get it. And they said, give up, Jim. God's way is always smooth. No, it's not. God's way is always better, but it's not always smooth. Get phone numbers. Use them. That's what my sponsor told me to do. He said, go to speaker meetings, go to book meetings, call people. Start looking at your character defects, if necessary, through other people. And I did everything he said. And I told him, though, because I was interviewing for another sponsor after that voice recorder. I said, if you tell me what you did to get better, I'll do that, but don't make no shit up. Because I didn't want what he had. I just didn't want what I had. And I think that's the only requirement, is that we don't want what we have anymore, and we're willing to do something about it. And we're willing to take on a different course of action and make it a way of life. And that's what it takes to get in here. And that's what it takes to stay here. A woman told me one time, you wear AA like a loose garment. Not so restricted that it chokes you and binds you. And not so loose that it falls off and you get arrested for indecent exposure. But build that relationship with a higher power and your friends and work on your character defects. And love everybody you come in contact with. You ain't got to like them. You got to love them. Accept those things in your life that you may not care much about. Because you have to. You don't have to like them. You just have to accept them. You know? And get into service. And do what you can for other people. Start paying it forward. You know, my sponsor told me that the God of my misunderstanding has all the gold and cattle and silver on 1,000 hills. And I cannot outgive God. And that's true. No matter where I give anything, my time, my money, my resources, it always comes back. Often not from where I gave it, but somehow, somewhere, it comes back. Today I have a life that continues to exceed my expectations on a regular basis. And as a result of you people, these steps, and a God that loves me far beyond my capacity to deserve it or my ability to receive it. I'll end with this. One of the phone numbers I got was about I've been in the program for 20 some odd years. And he said, call me. Call me anytime. So I did. It was very high maintenance early on in my recovery. I would call my sponsor, can I go to the store? Yep, stay out of the beer and wine aisle. Okay, I will. And so I called this guy because I could kind of felt as though I could kind of talk to him and he wouldn't put me on the spot like my sponsor would. And I called him and I called him, and sometimes pretty odd hours. And he told me two things. He said, going forward, and this applies to everybody in recovery that's avid, that's taking the action necessary, that's open-minded and willing and honest, the fundamental things we need to get that change that brings about recovery so that we can change our thought and our attitude and overcome our disease. He said, from this day forward, Number one, every day is going to be an opportunity for you to improve your character and increase your faith. And number two, don't call me before 9 a.m. I said, gotcha. So, 9:01, there I would be. But this is a wonderful thing. I want to thank those people that allowed me to come here and spend some time with you people. And I pray that we meet again. Thanks for letting me share.